Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Weven. Alongside me, as always, is my co-host, Mr. Chad Out of This World, Riley.
Howdy, hey, I'm not alongside you, I'm across from you. We shall cross swords with witty repartee, en garde.
And also with us tonight is Mr. Spencer Alien Williams. Sorry.
You keep trying to give us the same last name.
That's not a bad thing.
Spencer, I accept you into my family.
Thank you, but like, different.
You're making it a bad
thing. I know, it's not your name. That's what it comes down to. It's not your name.
Speaking of foreign names, we got a great show in store for you tonight. As we're going to be talking about an out-of-this-world film that debuted this past weekend, First Man. But before we do, Chad, give him a little bit of that opening info.
Sure will. Whether by small steps or giant leaps, the Filmlosophers podcast is brought to you by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios. In case you didn't realize it, this is a long-term commitment, but we promise not to quiz you as things develop. Subscribe to the Filmlosophers on any of your favorite streaming platforms. New lessons drop each Wednesday morning on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom. Spencer, where else can they find us?
Are your opinions ready to blast off with the force of an Atlas V rocket?
What?
Well, then you might consider turning them down a notch before connecting with us online. We can't hear you when you're shouting, you know. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101.
Yeah.
And finally, we might not be able to fly you to the moon, but we can excite you with more than 100 previous episodes that cover almost every film genre imaginable. Really. Just take a look at our episode archive on filmlosophers.com.
That's right. We had a whole slew of them. This is lesson 135.
Five.
135. We have 135 episodes underneath us, guys.
It's halfway to 270.
Very true.
Yes, that is very true.
But like we said, we got a great show in store for you today as we will be talking about the most recent film from Damien Chazelle, First Man. This film just really was one of the bigger talking points for Damien Chazelle right after La La Land was finished with production. It was actually immediately announced that Ryan Gosling was going to be taking the lead role of Neil Armstrong in this film right after production ended. And it's been one of the more anticipated films, in my opinion, because of the awesomeness of what Damien Chazelle did with La La Land. As well as...
almost won an Oscar. Well, they did. Emma Stone. Justin Hurwitz, Emma Stone, several people won Oscars. But the film almost won, but then it didn't.
It didn't. That was...
It's a lie, Warren Beatty.
That was like one of the
Faye
most...
Faye Dunaway.
One of the most awkward moments in like Oscar history.
Hey, it gets people watching. At least like the next day, you watch the clips.
It's true. Damien Chazelle, though, has had a really interesting film career in terms of his last two films with... La La Land, and then you also had the previous film, Whiplash. So seeing him take on something more historical has actually been of some interest to me because I'm not a huge history buff, but I do like films that have a sense of comparison to it where I can definitively say, okay, this is how the film is, this is how this is being portrayed. So it gives me a good basis to kind of compare it to and review it towards. So before we get into it, Chad, give him that official synopsis goodness.
Absolutely. On July 20th, 1969, American Neil Armstrong famously became the first man to set foot on the moon. But his journey to the lunar surface began several years earlier and was marked equally by triumph and tragedy. First Man takes an in-depth look at the rigors of America's competition against Russia to reach the moon and establish dominance in the space race, while also chronicling the deeply personal journeys of Armstrong, his wife Janet, and several other members of the NASA team.
Yep, directed by Damien Chazelle, as we previously mentioned, the film stars Ryan Gosling, Claire Foy, Kyle Chandler, Jason Clarke, and Corey Stoll. The film is based on the biographical novel by James R. Hansen with a script adapted by Josh Singer. If you're not familiar with the name Josh Singer, he's actually been the one who was one of the writers for The West Wing. He wrote The Fifth Estate.
The Fifth Estate.
And The Post, which was a really big film a few years ago.
Last year, actually.
Yes. Was it last year?
You can hear all about it on Lesson 96 of the Film Lossifers podcast.
As well as Spotlight. So, Josh Singer actually has had a really good introduction in terms of creating that like conspiratorial type of filmography and whatnot. So it's
well and biographical, you know.
Yeah,
really grounded in reality. All of his previous work. Well, I mean, The West Wing is more, you know, based on the presumed realities of within the four walls of the White House, and then the other films that he's worked on are all based on true life stories.
Yeah. The score of the film was done by Justin Hurwitz. If you're not familiar with him, he's actually worked closely with Damien Chazelle on his previous two films, including La La Land and Whiplash. And both of those films are heavily like ingrained in music. So, you know, if your film's going to be like driven by the music, you got to have a great composer. Mm-hmm. And Justin Hurwitz has just, in my opinion, delivered every single time.
He got an Oscar for La La Land, I believe.
Yeah. And Whiplash, I don't know if either of you have seen Whiplash, but Whiplash is the film
drumming.
About the drummer.
Yeah.
But that film as well, like in terms of cadences of drum beats and drum patterns, it's really interesting how they interwove that into the whole story overall. So that was really...
By the way, a little Filmlossifers trivia for you. If you've heard us name drop La La Land quite a few times, there's a reason for it. You can catch our review of that on Lesson 46. You got to dig into the archives a little bit.
That's true. It was one of our first ones. And then, of course, cinematography. You got cinematography for the film, which in this particular film, it's really incredible to see how they utilize some of the shots and some of the interesting aspects for the space race, the things that they see. And,
A lot of what you heard from the earliest press audiences for First Man was a lot of commentary about how the film really kind of puts you in the cockpit, like puts you in these, dare I say, death trap machines that are shaking and rattling, and you don't know if they're going to come apart or blow up or catch on fire or, you know, whatever. And it puts you almost claustrophobically sometimes in like the astronauts' seats, like in their position, so that you can feel a little bit of what they felt.
Yeah.
You know, I think I took that the wrong way when I first heard that and, like, you know, a few of the trailers. Because, like, for some reason, I just got this, like, sense of, you know how, like, they put out those 3D movies and it's all like, where they just, like, stick
Spencer's
their hands
trying, out. Spencer apparently thinks this is a video podcast because he tried to...
We do it all the time, whatever. But, like, it kind of gave me, like, that impression without seeing it. And I was like, I don't know about this. But they actually really pulled it off, I think.
Yeah.
Especially with the sounds of just everything.
Yes, that is, like, going to be a huge talking point for
not
us.
Not the soundtrack, just the sounds. The sounds. And stuff.
The film did have an estimated budget of about $60 million, but oddly enough, the box office haul from this past first weekend of wide release only brought in about $16 million. So I don't know what that was all about.
It's just people waiting.
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, hopefully after people listen to our show, they'll go and say, we should see it. Because needless to say, we were impressed. We got a chance to see this film. And honestly, I'm not a big... I like sci-fi films. I like space films. The problem with me when you get into, like, the more realistic type of space films is that I want the ridiculousness. You know, I want, like, the alien life forms. That's like why I enjoyed Arrival so much, because there was a sense still of fantasy to it. When you get into like to the space exploration aspect of most films where there's so much rooted in reality that it's like, oh, that's right. Space exploration has a lot to do with math. And I hate math. I was like, that's my mindset every time. And I hate to say that I am not a big fan, but I wouldn't say it's my first go-to for these types of films.
I mean, definitely, you've got, like, yes, there's not math in this film. I mean, yeah, they're engineers, and they're, at different points, they're studying from textbooks and everything, but they're not, like, doing math in front of you. You know, it's a little more engaging than that. I mean, it's not, not to say that this isn't engaging, but a movie like Hidden Figures, which we covered in Lesson 48.
Yes, we did.
That was very math-focused. Like, that was all about the behind-the-scenes calculations and all kind. Well, I mean, it was about a lot more than that. The viewpoint you had on the space program was more through the mathematics.
Yeah.
In that particular story, this one is very much in the cockpit. I mean, you start the film.
Yeah.
With Neil Armstrong years before the space program really was fully up and running, and he's in a test, like a rocket plane.
Yeah.
And I mean that was intense. You know, but you're in the cockpit with him. So it's definitely, and he's an engineer, but he's also a pilot, like a test pilot. I mean, it's the way that some of those streams, those job roles and functions crossed over is fairly unique. I don't know how frequently that happens nowadays, you know, in you know, with the space program or other similar initiatives, you know, how many engineers are also pilots or vice versa. You know, I'm not sure. Maybe there are a lot.
True. And I think my biggest issue is probably then that there isn't enough film. There aren't enough films that are rooted in the reality of what it takes like this in terms of space exploration. Like, if we look at the history of cinema, you probably could name like maybe two or three that actually have some basis of reality in it. Like, you take Apollo 13.
Love that movie.
Incredible movie. But it was done, like, what, back in 97?
Something like that, yeah.
And then, like you mentioned, Hidden Figures is another one. Those are honestly the only two films that I can actually think of that have to do with actual space exploration without adding a fantasy aspect. You know? Like, if I think about space exploration, I could probably say Armageddon. But Armageddon has an asteroid coming. And likewise, like, I could think of Contact, but Contact has Alien as well.
Yeah.
There's not many space exploration films or even films that have to do with space just in general or reaching the stars that doesn't have some fantastical element to it. So I think for me, I'm limited in what I've seen. So I judge it based on, number one, what I already know about it, which I know space stuff takes a lot of math and I don't like math. It's that much that I don't like it that it actually affects the way I see movies. Go figure. And secondly, there is a sense of limited amount of exposure to it. And I would love to see more. I just haven't been exposed to that much.
Well, and I would say also, and to get a lot more to the point with this film, what NASA or whatever group of government organizations kind of cobbled together to form NASA, the type of person that they were looking for as an ideal candidate was maybe not the mathematician always, but like was definitely the cool under pressure, not overly dramatic or given to flights of fancy. Like, it wasn't the creative type of person that they were looking for to pilot these crafts and figure this stuff out and go to the moon, 100%. Among other things. There were a bunch of kind of sequential steps that led up to going to the moon. And so when those are your subjects and you're trying to be true to history, you're not going to have a lot of, you know, let's throw a plate at the wall, get into a car accident, you know, have, you know, some kind of a, I don't know, chase of, you know, a husband chasing his wife in the rain to try to pursue her again. And like, they're just, you've got to stay true to reality. Yes, you're dramatizing all of it because we weren't there with, you know, documentary film cameras the whole time. But Neil Armstrong is not an unknown figure. I mean, he's a prominent figure in 20th century history at the very least. You know, the initial quote from him stepping onto the moon is extremely famous, and the tone with which he delivered it. So, you know, you've got to stay true to your roots, so to speak, your historical roots. And that can be a limiting factor, you know, when you're trying to also make a high-earning film heading into awards season, where
100%
people are often, you know, with a film like this, you're looking for like drama with a capital D.
Mm-hmm.
You're not looking typically for understated, like, look at all the subtext in the actor's face.
Yeah.
Because he sure isn't speaking it or showing it with his posture or whatever. Like, there is a lot of nuance that goes into a performance like this because of who you're staying true to, because of the people that they looked for to begin with to be a part of the space program. Mm-hmm. They didn't need a bunch of egos, you know, jockeying for a position. They needed guys who knew how to follow instructions and would stay calm and stay cool when things went off the rails.
So true. So diving right into this, before we jump into the actual review itself, let's go ahead and go around the table and talk about expectations. And I'll go ahead and kind of kick this thing off in terms of what I was expecting. And honestly, it doesn't veer too far away from what I was mentioning earlier. I was honestly expecting a film that the ability to keep me engaged was going to be teetering. Like, I thought if it was going to be a true-to-form space film, it was going to have a lot of the stuff that I don't like looking at, a lot of algorithms, a lot of numbers on boards and chalkboards and people losing it and going nuts and, you know, trying to figure things out and this and that. I honestly did, because I wasn't too sure of what to expect. It was going to be a true-to-form biography, and from what I knew from history and history classes and history books, I don't know about you guys, but the vast amount of information that I had on Neil Armstrong was completely limited to, you know, one small step for man, one giant, like, that was the brunt of what I knew. So coming into this, I really wasn't too sure how interesting his story was going to be. Like, you obviously knew Ryan Gosling is a pretty incredible performer. He's done, you know, great things with his roles and whatnot in previous films, but this is Neil Armstrong, and I don't remember reading anything about his life prior to, kind of thing. So I was just weary of those two things, you know, the actual being true to form with focusing too much on math and the ability to keep me engaged with...
Not the numbers.
Not the numbers. The bees. No, sorry.
Oh, gosh.
No, but yeah, those were my two biggest fears, in all honesty. My biggest expectations or worries, however you want to put it. So what about you, Spence?
Well, let's see. I kind of follow the same boat as you, as I don't really know much about Neil Armstrong or our space program, to be perfectly honest, because that's one of those things, like, when I was watching the movie, I was like, oh, I didn't think about this right as a kid, and I've had the whole wrong idea the whole time.
Hmm.
Because, like, I was thinking about, like, yo, we went to space, and Neil Armstrong did this in 1969, but, like, as I was learning about it, I was thinking about the 90s rockets, not the 1960s
That's right.
rockets. So, going into this movie, like, when you're first faced with, like, the rocket, you're like, you're sending him out in a tin can? Like,
pretty much.
That's insane. And we did that as a country, which is crazy.
We sent a man with a bunch of diodes and levers sitting on top of 2 tons of rocket fuel.
Yeah. We did it multiple times, in fact.
That's crazy.
It's
they happened insane. To be the first, but we did more.
Yeah, so that was my expectation going into the film.
By the way, our dear friend Spencer is a bit under the weather. So if you hear, you know, some growling and grunting and sniffling and snuffling, that's
him being
because,
normal.
You know, he's under the weather, and we've tried to dose him with some tea.
It's true.
It's mixed nice,
with
actually
mixed
Thank
with
you.
Robitussin.
For my part, I was really excited for this film.
You actually were.
I've been to Cape Canaveral. Huh. I wanted to be an astronaut when I was a kid. I learned very quickly that I was disqualified because I'm legally blind, and I didn't want to be a scientist first, so my only road would have been as a pilot, but they only need, like, perfect vision people to be pilots. They don't need people who can't see without vision correction. So my dreams were dashed at an early age, and that was okay. But
poor little child.
I went back and forth. Now, I became neither of these things, but I went back and forth between paleontologist, the study of dinosaur fossils, and astronaut. Going to space. So the extreme past, or like looking toward the future of all mankind. I was, I guess I just like the extremes. But But I've been to Cape Canaveral. Hmm. It's a really, really cool experience to go there, even as a tourist, and not go to, like, I mean, I never went to space camp or anything like mm-hmm. that. But it's just like the size, the scale of everything is, I mean, just there, even to see it in something like Apollo 13 or here in First Man mm-hmm. or some of the other films that have been made before, to stand in the space and try to register the scale of the sizes of these rockets, these vehicles, the launch pads, the assembly facilities, the movers that take them from the facility to the yeah. launch pad, just all of it, the amount of fire and water and everything else under the sun, the peeling paint as it's taking off, the all the...
Is that what that is?
Just the size and scope of this entire operation. It's mind-boggling. I mean, it is awesome. The other thing that was really cool in terms of like when we went to see this about, what, 3 days after the most recent SpaceX launch mm-hmm. that had that beautiful, like, dusky sunset blast off over yeah. the Los Angeles area with the big corona after the, you know, the plume of the exhaust, and everybody thought it was an alien.
I was just going to say, and all of LA thought it was an alien.
Or like a rift in space-time opening over the city of LA, because yes. of course it would happen over LA, if mm-hmm. anywhere.
Of course.
And so, I don't know, there was just something about the timing of us seeing the film also that, like, I already had all these things kind of kicked up from my childhood.
Yeah.
So I was really excited. Also, like you guys, I don't know a lot about Neil Armstrong
yeah.
specifically, like his home life, how he became the first man to walk on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know any of that.
Yeah.
And thankfully, the film opens with a couple of different sequences. One of them, as mentioned before, like in the cockpit with him, and then one of them at home with his daughter that really introduce the dominant visual and emotional motifs of the entire movie. So it helps to kind of put you into a certain context within yeah. the first 10 minutes.
Easily. I think that's one of the smartest things with this particular film. And we'll jump into this as we continue forward in terms of the film. But just to kind of state this, I think that's one of the greatest things that Damien Chazelle has brought with his films, is that ability to create the balance between the great dialogue and directing visual performances. And I think that's one of the things that really has to stand out for this particular role, because Neil Armstrong he's not a very talkative guy. So apparently from Ryan Gosling's performances, so you have to be a very physical performer and emote through your facial expressions. And so,
well, and they worked very closely with James Hansen, who mm-hmm. was Neil Armstrong's biographer for a number of years, and with Neil Armstrong's family.
Yeah.
To make sure that they had certain sort of character qualities and tonality right and accurate.
So jumping into the film, Chad had mentioned about the opening scene where you do get a chance to see Ryan Gosling as Neil Armstrong trying to test this rocket going into the atmosphere. But like Chad also mentioned, that kind of establishes the range between that and his, you know, experience with his daughter, and how those two dominant forces are going to be the ones that drive him the most throughout this entire film. So it's very well established early on. You're also introduced to Neil's wife, whose name is Janet, I believe.
Yes.
Janet Armstrong.
She goes by Jan, but I believe her given name is Janet.
Yeah. True. Who's played by Claire Foy. And you're also, as the film continues, you're introduced to the rest of the group, such as Kyle Chandler, Jason Clarke, Corey Stoll. Oddly enough, Corey Stoll plays Buzz Aldrin. And just a side note, I never knew Buzz Aldrin was such a jerk. And I'm not too sure if that's real or not, but I'm like, man, I would have not want to have been his friend.
Yeah, someone put him on blast, and I was kind of surprised about that.
Yeah, whether if it's like from the biography or like they're actually taking that information. I'm like, man, I'm not a big fan of Corey Stoll just because he always seems to play like either the villain or a bad guy. But he's really making it hard for me to like his character.
Well, Buzz Aldrin for many, many years was one of the more outspoken of the Apollo astronauts in terms of like doing press interviews and commenting for, you know, news documentary, you know, features and being in books. I think he's authored or co-authored several books. So he, in terms of like the media presence, and being remaining in the public eye, he really did that more than most of the other Apollo astronauts. I mean, definitely more so than Neil Armstrong.
Most definitely. And if there's ever any, you know, fact based in this film, that was one thing that was constantly translated, that Neil Armstrong was a man of few words, but when he did speak with passion, and he was to the point. You know, he didn't waste anything that he was saying.
Yeah, I mean, he was there to do a job.
Yeah.
And he knew what the stakes were, he knew what the goal was, and he kind of had a singular vision and purpose, even at the expense of other things that probably deserved his attention.
Yeah, no doubt. And I kind of want to like just highlight Ryan Gosling in this particular film, or in this particular performance. I've been a fan of Ryan Gosling for a while now. Not a big fan, but I've enjoyed his performances prior to. I saw him in the Goosebumps episode. I saw him in the Are You
Going
Afraid of the Dark?
Deep cuts.
Are You Afraid of the Dark episodes?
Mickey Mouse Club.
I didn't actually see him in the Mickey Mouse Club. So
wait, that was on in the 90s?
The Mickey Mouse Club?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm only familiar with the 50s version with Annette.
Wow.
Funicello. No, they redid it. It was, what, half of NSYNC, Ryan Gosling, yeah. Britney Spears, what? Christina Aguilera. Yeah, they all were together.
I have never heard of this.
Really?
No, this is brand new.
He's so young.
But even after he got out of that kind of stuff, and some of his, like, one of the most influential performances that I've ever seen him do is a really independent film that I don't think much people have seen, and it's called True Believer. It's a film from 2001. He plays a Jewish boy who, for some reason, becomes convinced to join a white power group. And he joins them, and he does a lot of really, really heinous things, but he has this like crisis of conscience during the time. And he does one thing that I've always noticed about Ryan Gosling is he does torture, like suffering in silence, really well, in my opinion. Like when he does those types of things, like we were talking about in one of the episodes prior to with Blade Runner, which is lesson 83.
2049.
Blade Runner 2049. He does a really great job in not talking as much in that film, but he actually...
Do you really want to go there?
Well, I paid attention to the whole film.
I fell asleep twice.
He fell asleep. But I really
like... And I love Denis Villeneuve.
I really like...
I'm excited for Dune.
Oh, 100%. No doubt. But like, I think Ryan Gosling has the ability to be such a physical performer in terms of his expression and the way he emotes and the way he just, you know, has his emotional outbursts in film. I actually find that sometimes more appealing than just people who can talk and talk and talk on screen. And I think he's one of those ones that really does it well. And in this particular film... He had to, because Neil Armstrong just isn't that much of a talkative person, like we previously said.
Well, and even the culture of that time, and arguably, I'd say even today, in terms of what's expected of a grown man in terms of showing emotion, showing, you know, what you're going through, like the reality of what a traumatic experience does to you on the inside.
Yeah.
There are still to this day... like social norms and potential blockages that, I mean, as a guy in modern day American society, like, yeah, I'm not afraid to shed a tear in a poignant moment in a movie theater.
Yeah.
But put me in the sunlight in front of somebody and I'm going to try to like run to a cave somewhere and do it privately. Like there's just, and I don't think that's all just because I'm wired that way. I think some of it is, it does feel almost instinctive for me, but also, I think that there is a certain level of expectation, and I think that it was much stronger back, you know, at this time in the 60s. Yeah.
That's a great point, and I didn't really actually think of that, but you're right. I think that is something that you have to consider, especially when this particular film really tries to create a moment in history type of feel where, like, if you were actually there watching it happen, and I think that is part of the adding to the effect of men who were just the breadwinner of the house. They were the head of the household. They were the ones who made all the rules, and this is how the norm was in society. So that's actually a good point. I didn't think of that.
Yeah, and one of the things that they get to very quickly, I mean, there are two really strong motifs in this film. One of them is that, like, sitting on the shoulder of the astronaut in a cockpit that is, you know, probably going to fall apart and let you fall to your doom in burning up in the atmosphere or falling all the way from space to the ocean or whatever. Like, I mean, you definitely have a strong sense of, like, Spencer, you were mentioning, like, is this a tin can with nuts and bolts, like barely holding it together? Is it like super glued? Is that what we're doing now?
Yeah.
You definitely get this like rickety, and you know, like this was, they were working under ridiculously extreme conditions in terms of like the pace and the time frame of all the advancements that they needed to create technologies that didn't exist.
Yeah.
And the fact that it worked is mind-boggling. But so you definitely have that like visceral in the cockpit as it's shaking, possibly disintegrating. You know, you have that kind of thing that you feel through the sound system and the visuals and whatever. But also you have this motif of loss that begins with the loss of their two-year-old daughter, Neil and Jan. They have a son and a daughter to begin with, and the daughter has a tumor, cancer, that they can't find the right treatment, you know, before she passes. And it's a dominant theme through his entire journey from where you first meet up with him through to standing on the moon. And some of that is creative liberty, for sure, taken by the team here. And I believe I've read some interviews, you know, with the biographer as well. And he took some liberties in his book, you know, that this film is adapted from. So, you know, they were taking their cues from him to a certain degree. But then the daughter is not the only, you know, close individual who doesn't make it, you know, close to Neil, who doesn't make it to this lunar landing. I mean, several astronauts lose their lives, and this is historical fact. In different ways. They're not, it's not all like one of them, I believe, was what, like a helicopter crash or a prop plane crash, just traveling.
Yeah.
And then others, it's like as part of the program, something malfunctions and they don't make it past a certain stage. Like literally life-wise, physically they perish. You know, and so it's sort of this motif of how does he deal with the pressure?
Yeah.
I mean, really it's this, not even a slow build, it's this constant pressure that's always kind of humming there in one form or another.
Yeah. I think it's really said well in the film where there's a particular scene where Neil Armstrong had just had a lunar module training session, and it ends up going awry, and he has to eject out of it, causing him to like be dragged by his parachute. And he's talking to his superiors, and the first thing they're telling him is, you know, like, well, you know, wait, we got to talk about it. He's like, no, he's like, we need to fail down here so we don't fail up there. And when they asked, you know, but at what cost? And he said, isn't it already a little too late for that? And I think that scene in itself put the entire film in perspective in terms of, you know, they're literally putting their lives on the line for something they don't even know is going to be a success. And like Spencer was saying, yes, those things look like they were like welded together and riveted together and just kind of, and I think that the film does a really great job in terms of having you guys, like having us as the audience, sit in with them to hear every creak, every bend, every movement of the metal, every piece of scraping. I'm like, I would go nuts if I had to sit on all that rocket fuel and trust that every single noise is supposed to be happening.
Oh, I would not be in this machine. This machine is a death trap because it killed people.
It's so like, those are like the most extreme. I don't want to say daredevils because it's not a daredevil type of thing. It's, but it's like the bravery is like off the charts, and in recognizing like what was sacrificed at the time to see the fact that these people had to put so much trust in a program that they didn't even know was going to be successful. They didn't even think it was going to be done. They were just knew that they had to try and try and try until they actually did.
And what's crazy is, like, even when there was a failure, like, people still came back and, like, to try to take it to the finish line.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's just crazy. Like, our space program is crazy. It's amazing.
It's incredible what they were able to accomplish. The other thing I really love about the film is showing the camaraderie. Mm. Like, in the midst of tragedy and unexpected setbacks and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's not like, I think a lot of people have an sort of that top-down authoritative view of like, well, these people were in charge and these people were the peons, so to speak. And so you just, you march to the beat of the drum and you followed orders. And I think what the film does really well in small touches here and there is shows that they're all comrade, like they're all... they're all friends to a certain extent. They have care and consideration for each other as human beings, not just, you know, I'm mission control and you're the poor sap who gets to sit on top of that rocket in a tin can. You know, they're all working together toward a common goal for many, many years.
Yeah.
It didn't happen in like a month.
No.
It didn't happen in 18 weeks. It happened over the course of year after year after year after year after year.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the eye-opening things for me in terms of, we mentioned earlier, we don't really have a vast amount of knowledge when it comes to said astronaut Neil Armstrong or any of the astronauts that rode any of those Gemini missions or even the Apollo missions. I honestly don't know. I know of the names, and I know of the most, you know, most well-known feats, obviously, like the first man to orbit the Earth was, you know, Buzz Aldrin, the first person to land on the moon or step foot on the moon, Neil Armstrong, you know, a lot of those little things. But like, to find out that before Neil Armstrong actually walked on the moon, he went through a lot, like, from, like you were saying, years of not just training but trial and error and failure and failure and success and failure and failure and failure and failure and losing friends. That's one of the things that I really respect about the film, is its ability to translate the fact that these people had genuine care and compassion for each other. Because you think of it and it's like, okay, maybe it's a competition. This person wants to be the person that goes and does this. This person wants to do that. Then you think, in my mind, I think business, and I'm like, oh, well, business is usually cutthroat. People like step over other people just to get that top seat. And in this case, they're like, oh, you're going to do this? Great. And blah, blah, blah. Or you're going to be doing this? Awesome. And they supported each other. They were there for each other. They were even in mission control when things were going on so that they could still know what's happening. Mm-hmm. And it was like, that's something that I would have never thought. Like, I thought NASA was all competitive. But to know that there was true care and compassion, and the span of how long it took was so vast, I began thinking of like a whole different perspective in terms of the space program. And that's a trip to me. So...
But, well, and I think too, I mean, like, just some of the nature of some of the setbacks, like there's one particular kind of, they do a pretty good job of in very broad brushstrokes outlining, in order to land a man on the moon and bring him back, we need to do this and 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 this. Oh, by the way, the Russians are already doing that part faster than us. And like, there's a lot of just the consideration that goes into building a plan to make it to that goal involves hundreds and thousands of other plans.
Yeah.
One of which is successfully successfully docking with another craft in orbit, in Earth orbit. And something goes wrong.
Yeah.
And it is like, I don't know about you guys, but I like physically remember the dizziness of Gravity with Sandra Bullock, where she's like on a tether spinning around. She's there's all this spinning, everything's always spinning, debris going everywhere. This takes that concept and traps you in a tin can, and you are spinning, and you can't see how close you are to the Earth, how far you are from the Earth. Like, is something breaking? Is the attachment decoupling? Are you going to vent atmosphere? Like, you're blacking out. What's going to happen? Like, it's intense.
Yeah.
And it's not just like a 10-second thing. It's like a 2.5-minute sequence.
Yeah.
Again, it really puts you in the middle. I mean, you're like in a centrifuge.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. It's because that particular scene, it doesn't even catch you. Like, you don't even expect it. It completely catches you by surprise because there's something going on. The guys are trying to figure out something, and all of a sudden, everything flies to one end, and the thing starts spinning, and it's insane because, like Chad said, I actually remember feeling, like, deep down, like, nauseous from watching it, but I couldn't stop looking because I wanted to see how they were going
to
resolve
it. Yeah, you're like, well, I know he goes to the moon, so how the heck did he fix this?
Exactly. I'm like, we're going to keep watching. Just trying to see, like, what the whole game plan was, because you see how they're trying to make sense of it up there, and then you see how Mission Control is completely helpless down there, down on the ground, and it's such an intense scene.
Well, they were in like a radio blackout zone. Like,
yeah.
Mission Control didn't even know what was going on.
Yeah.
Until it was basically done. Like, you're either going to survive or perish.
No, completely.
And then, like, oh, the radio signal's back. <You're> like, he had to make that call all on his own. You know, it's crazy.
It is.
The things that you learn.
And I think that's part of like the way Damien Chazelle does storytelling in terms of like continuing to deliver a solid story through a film and then input parts that you don't expect. I think of Whiplash and the whole scene where he first begins drumming for his teacher and the teacher goes nuts and like ends up throwing a chair at the head of the drummer, and it completely catches you unaware, but there's an intense meaning behind it and there's such emotion. This film does that on several occasions where you're watching and you're engaged, and then all of a sudden, not out of like a sheer jump scare type of feel, it's never like that. It's not cheap. It's not done poorly. This is a genuine moment of fear that could have happened to like any one of us. And well, the reality of it feels like it could naturally happen to us. But seeing how he creates that dread and that fear, and even in the moment, your hope of seeing this come on the plus side as opposed to like bad things happening, that draws you in. And I think that's great directing from Damien Chazelle. Like, I think he's a really great director, and I know he's only done two films prior to this, but I have to say every film he's done I've enjoyed, and this is another one of those films where his ability to create those moments just astound me.
Yeah.
And I know this isn't about space, what I'm about to say, but the first thing I told you guys when I got up is I would love to see Damien Chazelle do like a psychological thriller. Like, I think his ability to engage you not just with the dialogue but emotionally and even physically with what's happening, and then when things go awry, you're still looking at this huge beautiful train wreck, but you want to turn away and you know you should, but you're still watching. He creates that so well and with such ease. I'm actually hoping that maybe he does something like that in the near future. So
they also happen to give him very accomplished performers.
That is very
true. To help with this journey. I mean, I know we've gone on and on about Ryan Gosling because he's, you know, Neil Armstrong in this movie. But Claire Foy.
Mm-hmm.
I have not watched The Crown. I have not watched anything with her in it. This is my first exposure to her as a performer.
Mine as well.
And the thought that I had coming out of the theater was very similar to the thought that I had regarding in The Dark Knight Rises. The story role of Michael Caine as Alfred. So not the role of the character, but like in the emotional puzzle piece or I guess the storytelling puzzle piece, the block set.
Yeah.
Michael Caine in The Dark Knight Rises had to basically carry the entire emotional weight of the movie.
Yeah.
In, I don't know, 8.5 minutes of screen time. Like, he's not in the movie very much.
No.
And they gave him all of the heart pieces of the movie because the rest of it had to be so difficult.
Yeah.
In this case, I think that Claire Foy, as Jan, gets 80% of the emotional storytelling job.
Oh, and completely.
She does have more than 8 minutes of screen time, thankfully.
Thankfully.
but she doesn't have nearly as much as Ryan Gosling. Because you're following the space program and things that they do behind closed doors that obviously, as his wife, she wasn't privy to. But sometimes you're sitting in her living room with her, listening to the mission control feed through her radio.
Yeah.
When something goes wrong up in space and she doesn't know what's happening to her husband. And you've got a photographer there taking pictures in your living room of you reacting to the radio when NASA decides to stop giving your radio the signal.
Yeah.
When nothing is resolved. I mean, like, not to mention the relationship drama between the two of them, which for the bulk of the film, she is shouldering all on her own.
Completely. And I think that's one of the things that I same as you, I was completely unaware of her as an actress. I knew of her being in The Crown, which that's kind of on my to watch list because everybody talks about it as much as they do. She's also in those Into the Spider-Web or those films that are from overseas.
There's one coming out this week, I think, actually, The Girl in the Spider's Web. Yeah. She's the new... Oh gosh, I don't know the name. Lisbeth Salander, maybe something like that.
But like I'm aware of her, but I've never actually seen her perform, and to see how much she emotionally engages in this film, and it's like you can see like the demise of her spirit as things continue to go awry and things that she's suffering through. She recognizes, and she's just like at this, she's at her wit's end of trying to make sense of a lot of it. And you see the transition from the very beginning of the film where there was hope, there was these things, and then they lose their daughter, and then just things start going downhill for her. Not because of the space program, but because she's feeling the distance and she's feeling the separation of between her and Neil Armstrong. And you see her suffering for her children who are, you know, unsure if their dad's going to be coming home. There's a lot of things that are playing into this, and she carries them so well in this film that she plays this role perfectly in my mind. Mm-hmm. Like, and I wasn't even, like I said, I wasn't even a fan of her prior to, but I'm a fan of her now. So I'm going to have to binge the Crown this weekend.
My favorite part is when NASA did turn off her radio and she went down to NASA and she's like, oh, you're turning this back on. Well, we have protocols. It's like, do I look like I care, basically?
It's like, so good. This is amazing. At She's first, so I'm great. Like, you will not tell Coach Eric Taylor from Friday Night Lights what it's going to happen. But then I'm like, oh, no, you will, actually. I would listen to you.
She just did. She's like, oh, we'll put, no, you're going to turn it back on right now. Like, oh, I'm like, where's the switch by my seat? I'll turn it on myself.
Yeah. She just left without verifying or anything. She's like, oh, well, you're doing this. Bye. And like, just was out. It's like, wow.
Mic drop.
You do not want her coming back.
When you look at like period pieces, and I hate calling it a period piece because usually you're talking like 1700s, 1800s, you know, whatever. But when you're looking at a historic reflection and you're looking at the sort of the prevailing understanding of how certain people navigated their role in society at this time.
Yeah.
I think it would be an easy play to have Jan as someone who is... Now, granted, they had the benefit of actually talking to Janet, formerly Armstrong. They divorced a couple decades after he landed on the moon. The pressures ultimately were too much for their relationship. It looks like, but they had her as a consultant for the film. She actually influenced a change that they applied to the end of the film. In fact, and so, you know, maybe they glean this from the actual Janet Armstrong, but it was an easy choice to play this role as someone who was like the long suffering wife whose like emotions are leaking out around the edges, mm-hmm. and that is not this character.
No, like, not at all.
There's almost this like passionate, I also almost want to call it a fury, that she is by an act of will putting a lid on most of the time.
Yeah.
Like, yes, she's fine. Like, she's not always angry. It's not like a permanent character setting, but there's this building, this mounting dissatisfaction and anger, and like, when is this going to end? Like, when do we have to always be doing this as a family? Is this what it's always going to be like?
Yeah.
And you get this like mounting frustration and her efforts to keep it under control, and that's what's sort of leaking around the edges. It's remarkable. It's a very smart, I think very relatable way of playing the role. And likely was influenced to a great degree by the actual woman herself.
No doubt, no doubt. And yeah, but aside from Claire Foy's character, you also have, like we said, you have Kyle Chandler, Jason Clark, Corey Stoll. As we mentioned, Corey Stoll plays Buzz Aldrin. Jason Clark plays another one of the astronauts named Ed White. And then, like Chad mentioned a little bit ago, Kyle Chandler plays Deke Slayton. He's kind of the overseeing supervisor.
Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. Gosh, I love that show.
And they're all great performers. Like, in this film, I have to be honest, I haven't really liked a lot of what Jason Clark has done as of late. It just doesn't seem to...
Terminator Genesis.
Exactly. That kind of probably...
I understand.
Exactly. And so, like, with his role in this one, he does a great job of, like, trying to work towards being that friend for Neil Armstrong, but at the same time, still struggling with a lot of the same thing that he is with the program, wanting things to go well, the hopes and the dreams and everything like that. It's a very enduring role for him, where he has to really rely on his ability to emote. He has to really rely on his ability to be expressive. There's a scene where Neil Armstrong, who has yet to talk about his daughter years after she's passed, has a moment where they look at a swing and Neil Armstrong says, you know, my daughter used to have a swing like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in that moment, you see Jason Clark's character light up because he's finally hearing Neil talk about his daughter. And it's like Jason Clark he's trying to find the words to follow up, to keep the conversation going, to keep him talking. And Neil says, well, I guess it's time for me to go. And like the disappointment on Jason Clark's face, it's translated so well. That scene is such a great scene for Jason. And I applaud him for it, because I have yet to see him do that in pretty much any other role prior to. So that was one of the standout things for me. Did you have any standout scenes that you really enjoyed, or even performances, Spence?
Oh, I told you, it's the one with Janet going down to NASA.
Oh, that one, yeah.
Yeah, that was my favorite scene.
What about you, Chad? Any other performances?
You know, I think that one of the things that I don't want to really go into detail on is something that they have Neil Armstrong do on the moon. That kind of, you know, in terms of story structure, it bookends the journey part of the story really well. And I looked into it just out of curiosity, like, did that really happen?
Yeah.
And there's no definitive proof that what they show, this one thing that he does on the moon, that ever actually happened.
Yeah.
However, he did take a private moment that was unscheduled. That's part of the historic record, if you will.
Yeah.
And the biographer... is the one, as I understand it, I haven't read the book, but he's the one that suggests that perhaps this is something that he might have done during that private excursion. It's really compelling, and it's something that's like so important because of the way that this movie is telling his story.
Yeah.
It's so important in a way that's just more relatable and personable, like personal, than I blasted off into space and landed on the moon and walked on the surface and then came mm-hmm. back. Like, that's all larger than life. Like, that's a character and a story, mm-hmm. not a human being.
Yeah.
Even though obviously he and the others who walked on the moon were human beings, or are still, some of them are still alive. But yeah, but then you have this decision that's made creatively
mm-hmm.
and may have been actually something that happened in real life, IRL, on the moon. But like, you have this moment where it's like, that I get, like that,
yeah,
that I feel that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'll ever know what it feels like to stand on the moon and look back at the Earth, but that I get it.
Yeah.
And it was a smart decision. Now, I will say, as we start to wrap things up, it took a little long to get there.
Very true.
Because this movie is not short. And I think that might be another reason why we've only seen $16 million or so in box office receipts. Because people are like, this is 2 hours and 20 minutes long. If it was 30 minutes shorter, I'd give it a try.
Yeah.
It's like, that's my whole evening right there. And I don't know if I'm willing to give that up for any moonwalker. It's true. Once this film hits the second act, you do see a little bit of a lull in the storytelling. Its ability to keep you engaged tends to dwindle because it deals more with like the logistical aspects of what's happening. It doesn't the action doesn't really happen as often, and it's all building towards that third act, which is, you know, obviously the official lunar or the official Apollo launch headed toward the moon and so forth. So the runtime is part of it, but like any good film, if you have a long runtime, you need to have a story that keeps you engaged, i.e. Lord of the Rings or sure. any of those types of epic films that keep you for vast amounts of time and you find yourself wanting still more. This is one of those perspectives on this film where the film, even though it was long, doesn't hold you for that long. And when it starts pulling out and starts losing your focus, you begin falling out of that film. You begin becoming disengaged, and that's not a good thing you want to have for a movie.
You
that's
start
this
noticing
long.
How much time has passed,
exactly,
which is not something that you want your audience to ever do.
So, any other issues? Any other things you guys saw, Spence?
No, that really is my main issue with this movie. Is that it's a bit on the long side.
Mm.
So yeah, don't be afraid to hire editors to chop it down just a touch.
And we did want to mention one other thing in terms of this film. One of the other great aspects of this particular film was its music selection and
yes!
its composition. I know Spence has been our kind of go-to for a lot of the music side, but what were some of the highlights for you in that, Spence?
The entire landing sequence on the moon was the standout moment musically and just in the movie of what they were doing. Because like it was a really good song, and it was a song that we were playing actually as we were introducing this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was great, and I haven't actually heard of Justin Hurwitz before because I guess I didn't see La La Land, so now I'm kind of very interested to go back and see what else he's done, because I'm very interested if that's his style. But no, like the music in this movie was pretty good.
Yeah. It kind of reminded me, that particular piece kind of reminded me, going back to another film we've actually reviewed prior to in Lesson 37, Arrival. Mm-hmm. One of the pieces of music that they have as part of the soundtrack was a piece by Max Richter called On the Nature of Daylight. And it's such a powerful and yet simple piece that's at the beginning of the film, and it's also at the tail end of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this like harmonic sound of violins and like symphony. It's beautiful, and you hear it and you become like instantly engaged in whatever's happening on the scene in the screen. And in this particular film, that's what that lunar landing sequence does for me. Like I'm mm-hmm. listening to it and I'm like focused. I'm like, they're gonna land. And I found myself drawn in, and it was great. And I'm actually like kind of like Spence. I'm anxious to see or listen to the full soundtrack now, because if that's just that small piece, I need to go back and revisit the entire soundtrack.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that both of those examples really are just master class examples of fusing. Like, here, this is one very accomplished example of the magic of film, where you've got the score and the storytelling so beautifully fused together. I can't listen to the Max Richter piece on The Nature of Daylight without feeling what I felt, especially by the end of Arrival.
Yes.
When you hear it again and everything is coming together in ways that you didn't expect and it's finally making sense and you're like crying on the inside and maybe on the outside too.
I was.
Like, I can't listen to that piece and not start feeling those things.
Yeah.
Because it was so perfectly, beautifully fused. Similarly here, that lunar landing sequence, that particular part of the score is so beautifully and perfectly stitched with the visual that even when, you know, we played it at the beginning of this episode, I'm seeing like the lunar surface going by below. And I'm like, how close is it? I don't know. Are we going to hit a mountain? Are we going to fall in a crater? I'm not sure. Oh, we landed. Gosh. I didn't figure out that it didn't. I thought it was going to bounce more. Like, you know, there's so much detail in the visual and intricacy in the score that plays so well together. Like, it just, it melts together in your brain.
100%. So wrapping this all together, this is one of those types of films where, as a biopic piece, as a film that's based on the life of somebody that, in all honesty, you may not really fully know. Like, I think all three of us can agree, we have a much more deeper knowledge of Neil Armstrong and his struggle. And I call it a struggle because it was a fight from beginning to end to figure out not only how he was going to get to the moon, but he knew for sure. It was like this determination in his heart and in his mind, he was going to get to the moon. And no matter who he had to neglect or whatever, you know, decisions he had to make.
And in a very real sense, he also had to reckon with his daughter's passing.
Yes. Like,
that was a very prominent theme throughout. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a huge part of his motivation.
Completely. So going around the table, let's go ahead and give ourselves the opportunity to rate this film at. And let's go ahead and start with Mr. Spencer Williams. How many does it pass or fail, and how many monocles?
This movie passes.
Okay.
And I will give it 4 out of 5.
Wow.
I was not really interested in seeing this when I saw the trailer, and I'm super glad I did because it was really fantastic. The music is on point. Really, the only things that are not good about it or the length, it could be a little bit shorter, but this movie will definitely challenge what you think you know about the space program in America in the 60s, which is really educational. So
it's scary.
It's odd that I learned something from this.
What about you, Chad?
I will also pass this film and give it 4 monocles. It would get 4.5. But I just, the runtime got to me. Like, and I wanted to be an astronaut as a kid. Like, I studied some of this stuff as a kid because it fascinated me. But still, it was a little long.
Yeah, same here. I have to agree with both of you guys. The film passes for me. It's a great example of what a true biopic does and what should do, which is transport you to the time where this entire thing takes place. I do feel, however, that the runtime is a huge knock to what this film could have been. Had it been 30 minutes shorter, I really felt it probably could have been 4.5 easily. But because of that lull in the second act, it does really hinder this film from becoming what it could be. I'm also going to give it 4 out of 5. Still, everything else was incredible. The soundtrack, the acting, everything. So, but yeah, that about wraps up another awesome review of the film. Let us know what you think. If you get a chance to see the film this week or anytime soon, drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Just to let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases, we got The Girl in the Spider's Web, actually starring Miss Claire Foy herself, and The Hate U Give. So get a chance. If you get a chance, check out your local listings and check out those films. This was a great episode. It was a great review, great conversation. And if you get a chance, like we said, this film, even though that runtime really does hinder, go out there and support your local cinema. Go out there and support your local movie makers and filmmakers and everybody in the industry, because it's people like that that keep us busy from time to time. So, but that about wraps it up. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.